Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 2nd, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. In his webcast last Tuesday, Lyndon LaRouche renewed his call for a war to defeat the modern-day British Empire. This empire today, more accurately the Anglo-Dutch Saudi Empire, is driving the world toward war while tightening its grasp on the Obama administration through its leading operatives inside the administration among the so-called behavioral economists, centered around Chief Economic Advisor Larry Summers. In his webcast, LaRouche detailed the role of these kooks in misleading the administration and using Obama's narcissist syndrome to drive the president toward policies that will ultimately destroy not only his presidency, but perhaps the United States as well. In an evaluation just released by Mr. LaRouche an hour ago, it's clear that Summers is not functioning simply as an economic advisor. On April 29th, Summers issued a statement which represents a break by the administration with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. In comments made at the Israeli embassy, Summers broke with previous administration policy, as enunciated repeatedly by Secretary of State Clinton and mouthed by President Obama, that Israel must negotiate in good faith for peace with the Palestinians. At this event on April 29th, Summers said that Israel must not sign a peace at any price. In other words, that they do not have to negotiate in good faith with the Palestinians. And he predicted further that Israel's warmongering Prime Minister Netanyahu would find a good reception when he came to visit with President Obama. This announcement puts the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama squarely within the strategic geometry imposed by the British in that region, that of the Sykes-Picot Accord from the early 20th century, which has been responsible for one war after another, all in service of the British Empire. And this represents a decisive break with what the administration, before then, had been doing under Secretary Clinton's direction. Today on our program, we're going to take up one of the fronts in this war, which is in Northeast Africa, as the British continue in their efforts there to destroy the nation of Sudan. One of the leading operatives for the Brits on this flank is the notorious protege of the Nazis, George Soros, who set up the International Criminal Court to target the leader of Sudan, President al-Bashir, and by implication, the nation of Sudan. Several weeks ago, a group of four members of the LaRouche organization attended a conference in Sudan, during which they had the opportunity to deliver a number of presentations on the role of the British Empire and LaRouche's role in leading the fight to defeat the anti-human forces centered in the city of London. They had the opportunity to speak with leaders of Sudan, with student activists there, and on our program today, we'll hear from two of the members of that delegation. Summer Shields, who's a leader of the LaRouche Youth Movement in the United States, who's on with us today from Essen in Germany, and Hussein Askari, the EIR International Bureau Chief in Stockholm, from which position he's actively involved in building a LaRouche presence in the Arab world and also building a LaRouche electoral force inside Sweden. So Summer and Hussein, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Thank you, Harley.
Hussein,
why don't we begin with you, Hussein. Give us a quick summary of your trip in Sudan. What was the purpose and what did you do?
Yeah, well, first of all, one important thing I have to say is that, you know, I think the work you are doing, the LaRouche movement doing, and Lyndon LaRouche is doing in the United States is extremely significant, not only for the United States itself, but also for the rest of the world. And the case of Sudan and what people in Sudan were saying to us and also what we're saying after we left signifies that, because as this statement from Summers, Larry Summers, you just mentioned about Israel and the fact that Israel or Netanyahu should not sign any peace agreement with the Palestinians, this is, it just signifies the whole point, because the fight you are leading against Larry Summers and these others who are turning the whole U.S. administration into the wrong direction once again for the disappointment of the whole human race The fight against them, which you are leading and Lyndon LaRouche is leading, is very, very important, because people are looking at the LaRouche movement, as we were told in Sudan, that the LaRouche movement are the ones who can change the direction of the U.S. policy. And this is the reason why they actually had a LaRouche group, and Mr. Lyndon LaRouche himself was personally invited, but could not go for many reasons, but that they decided to invite a group from the LaRouche movement, because they do believe that the work they are doing inside the United States and to a certain extent also in Europe is very important for the fate of Sudan, for the fate of Africa. And of course, we were in Sudan from the 4th to the 10th of April on the invitation of the General Union of Sudanese Students, who had arranged an international conference and inviting many experts and dignitaries from different parts of the world to discuss the question of the ICC, you know, the fight for international justice and to stop the politicization, what they call, of this question of justice, and to against the decision by the International Criminal Court to you know, which issued an arrest warrant, an illegal arrest warrant against the sitting president, President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan. And I mean, we were there for the time of the conference. We were giving the chance, and Lawrence Freeman, also the head of the LaRouche delegation from the United States, was giving the opportunity to speak in many different sessions, in the opening session, in the conference itself. He and I were presented as keynote speakers, actually, on the second day of the conference. And also had the opportunity to address different groups like the Sudanese Lawyers Association, the a big student gathering at the University of Africa, where students from all over Africa study there. And we were told that in that university, many African leaders actually studied. And we also had the opportunity to address the whole population, and including the Sudanese abroad, through the national television and their satellite television, to present the ideas of Mr. Lyndon LaRouche and what's wrong with this International Criminal Court. We were also had the opportunity to travel to northern Darfur, to the Darfur region in western Sudan, to see for ourselves, you know, the conditions of the refugees, what the government is trying to do, the question of the whole NGOs and the work they are doing, and how they are, if they are collaborating with the government or not, the UN work, the African Union forces there who are positioned to protect the displaced persons. And we had a very good chance to both talk with the displaced people, but also with the officials in that part of the country.
Hussein?
To get a real sense of the thing. I mean, the interesting thing is that during our visit, the President Obama's special envoy, Major General Scott Gration, was exactly the same week there in Sudan to hold discussions with the people in the government. But also after we left, Senator John Kerry, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was also in Sudan and had high-level discussions. But he went also to Darfur and to the same refugee camp. We were there. And the impression you get, everybody who goes to Sudan, and the impression they get, including John Kerry, who wrote, I think, an op-ed a few days ago where he said, you know, the picture you get is totally different from the one you get from the media in the United States itself or in Europe about what the reality of the situation there. I mean, there is no genocide. There is no systematic policy of the government to eliminate so-called Africans, because there are really no Africans and Arabs. Everybody there is a mixture. Including people who are in the government of Darfur, the local government in Darfur. It's a mixture, including there are people who were told who are actually descendants from people from Nigeria.
Hussein, let me ask you a question on this trip then of Kerry and the U.S. envoy, because one of the concerns of Mr. LaRouche has been that the Obama administration, on the one hand, is getting input from Susan Rice, who has a record with George Soros and with these NGOs, also Samantha Powers, that these are people who have been pushing the administration to support the ICC. But from what you're describing, that's not the U.S. policy at this point, as indicated by the envoy.
No, and also, I mean, the Sudanese officials and the media, what they were saying during the period is that actually this whole ICC question is a British-European operation. It's mainly the British and the French and other European countries who are leading this campaign against Sudan. And therefore, they were very hopeful that with the President Obama coming to power in the United States, that the U.S. policy will change, there will be a friendlier relationship to Africa. And actually, they wrote that the LaRouche movement, after the first day of the conference, that the LaRouche movement, the Sudanese newspapers wrote, have working intensively inside the United States to dissuade the Obama administration from supporting the ICC, and that Lyndon LaRouche is personally intervening on the administration through different channels to get Obama administration away from the British policy. And this was made official, and it was strengthened, actually, what they thought was going on was strengthened by General Gratian's statements, which were very friendly and focused on the question of solving the problems in Sudan, mm-hmm. getting the peace process going, strengthening the South-North peace agreement, which is already in place, the comprehensive peace plan, and also what John Kerry said there, and also when he left Sudan, strengthened the belief of the people inside Sudan, the officials and everybody, that the mm-hmm. U.S. policy is different than the British policy.
Good.
And they made it very clear in different meetings, but also in speeches they made, that this is the European imperial policy. Mm-hmm. And they know, because the people in Sudan, they have a history of the fight against the British.
Right.
And
right.
If you go around, you talk to even to young people, they tell you funny stories about when the British were in Sudan, the time of Kitchener, the time of Gordon, very humorous stuff. But it's a living sense inside the Sudanese population and the leadership that they are still in a fight against British imperialism. They don't understand every aspect of it, but this case of the ICC revealed to them, and the work we have done and LaRouche has done showed them exactly what we mean by the British Empire. Because you look at the ICC, it's the core of the Anglo-Dutch empire. And you look at the Soros involvement, the Open Society Institute, the Justice Initiative, and the Coalition for an International Criminal Court. These are all British, Dutch, and to a certain extent, other European countries are involved, including Scandinavia. But it's led by British, both official and unofficial institutions. And you look at the
including leading Soros operative Lord Malek Brown. Let me just get out to our listeners now that what you're going to hear on this program is going to be different from what you hear from George Clooney, for example, from the NGOs, which LaRouche says stands for No Good Organizations. And if you have a question for our guests, Hussein Askari and Summer Shields, please send it in to us at radio@larouchepub.com. radio@larouchepub.com. We'll hopefully be able to get to your questions. Let me go to Summer Shields right now. Summer, as this is your second trip to Africa as a member of the LaRouche Youth Movement, what do you find in terms of the views of the United States? Given the role that was played under the Bush administration, the fact that the U.S. has seemed to be supporting the attacks on the government of Sudan. I mean, President Clinton bombed Sudan. What do you find as the students, what do they think of the United States, and how were you received as an American?
I was very surprised by the support for the United States, despite the, as you said, the bombing under the Clinton administration of this pharmaceutical plant. But just to highlight what Hussein was talking about, none of the four power nations that LaRouche is calling for as the four major nations that would be required to get out of an economic hyperinflationary breakdown crisis, none of the four nations have shown any support for the ICC, and that's the United States, Russia, China, and India. So despite the fact that even though the U.S. has had some not very good policy towards Sudan, as Hussein was saying, the government doesn't lump in the United States into what they consider to be European imperialism, and that very much openly so. And so on both trips, both to, when I went to Nigeria before and this one in Sudan now, even more so in this one, there's a general acceptance of any sort of partnership that the United States would be offering towards Sudan. And this also came up with different government officials who seemed to be very pleased by General Scott Gratian's approach to handling the nation when he came to visit.
And you had a chance to talk to a lot of students at this conference?
Yeah, a lot. Really, they had student representatives from all over the Arab world and student representatives from different locations in Africa. And I got to address the student body, the General Union of Sudanese Students, for a short period, got to address them. There was a lot of anti-American sentiment coming from people who weren't Sudanese, largely that were in the Arab world, not hostile, but just, oh, the U.S. is, at one point, one guy even said the U.S. backed the ICC, and as Larry pointed out later to this guy, that the U.S. hasn't backed the ICC, and he said, well, that's true. But
these are generally the victims of the Sykes-Picot, you know, people from Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, you know, that area who are
right.
Still the Sykes-Picot mentality is running the thinking. I
mean, well, Hussein, as long as you bring this up, I'd like to not simply restrict our discussion to Sudan, and the Sykes-Picot agreement is critical because, as you know, and people who are familiar with what LaRouche has presented as a strategic overview, the region, really, which includes Egypt and Sudan, was part of the targeted operations at the end of the 19th century by the British. At the same time, they were moving from the Arab Bureau in Cairo to take over what we know today as the Middle East or Southwest Asia. So I want to come back to the Sykes-Picot thing, but and also I'd like to get a little later your comments on these really profound implications of this statement today from Lyndon LaRouche that Larry Summers' comments at the Israeli embassy in Washington represent a break between Obama and Hillary Clinton. But I want to just pursue a couple more aspects of the Sudan trip because I think this is really critical to get the truth out to the American people. Now, you were in North Darfur. You visited one of the displaced people's camps. Is that right?
Two of them.
And let's go back and start with you, Hussein. What did you see there? What is the government trying to do, and what do they say in Sudan is the problem in Darfur?
Yeah, one paradoxical thing, which is an irony of the situation we saw, is as we were going from this city, El Fasher, which is the capital of northern Darfur, towards in a car convoy to the camp, and I saw some of the huts, which were like small houses built of reed and branches of trees. And I said, oh, my God, these people really living in bad conditions, and these refugees. And the woman who was guiding us, she said, these are not refugees. These are the people of the city. They are living in these are the people who live in the outskirts of the city. We haven't yet arrived at the displaced people camp. So when we arrived at the displaced people camp, actually the living conditions were relatively it looked better because they have international focus to help those people in the camps. They have clean water. They have, I mean, living in refugee camps, of course, this is no decent human being would accept it unless you are forced to live in these conditions. These are not good conditions for human beings to live in.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in refugee camps on the border between Iraq and Iran. I'll tell you, it's exactly the same conditions. These are not made, they're not for human, permanent human existence, but what is there is that it's a normal situation where people get the minimum requirements of food, water, sanitation, health care. And I talked to some of the kids there, like 9 and 10 years old also, who I asked them if they go to school. And they said, yes, there is a school in the camp itself. So they actually have a living situation, which is not different than other people in Sudan living in the same area.
So you're basically
But the difference is that they have good care because the whole world is watching the situation, and the government itself is helping, to improve the conditions there. I mean, it's a totally peaceful area. What happened is that when the ICC issued its arrest warrant against the President al-Bashir, the government decided to get out of Sudan to stop the work of 13 organizations. But you have to remember that there are more than 100 humanitarian organizations working in these refugee camps. And the government itself and other organizations from Africa and Islamic countries tried to fill the gap, which was left by these organizations. Because these organizations, generally, their work is more political than humanitarian. They are part of the political process which goes on in Western, in Europe, and in the United States itself, which has a political aim. Because you look at the what these organizations offer, I mean, it's a known case that all these organizations, 70 to 80% of the income they get through donations goes to administrative functions.
Well, Hussein, let me ask you a question on this story of civil war, of massacres and things of that sort. There was a civil war at one point. There was a figure, John Garang, I believe, who was fighting against the Sudanese government. But there's been a peace agreement there. Was that the main opposition to peace, or are there still organizations that are trying to secede from Sudan?
No, that's in the southern Sudan with the Sudanese People's Liberation Army and the and movement. They got into an agreement already in 2002, 2003. They started a negotiations process, and they arrived at what is called a comprehensive peace agreement already in 2006, and they joined the government now. The southern Sudanese former rebels are members of the Sudanese government now. And they have an autonomy in southern Sudan in the areas where you had the civil war before. Yes, there was a civil war, but that's over now with the comprehensive peace agreement. It's not finalized totally, and that's why it was important that the U.S. administration's focus now is to get that agreement finalized and to stabilize the situation. But what you had as the negotiations were going on in that part of Sudan, and you remember the war in southern Sudan was supported by the British, by other Europeans, and even the U.S. Groups and organizations to support the southern rebels against the government itself, the same government. And you had people like Baroness Cox, the British, from the British House of Lords. She created a whole slave trade with money donated by Christian organizations. Right. To claim that the government of Sudan was aiding a slave trade, but it was Baroness Cox who created the slave trade. But exactly at the same time the negotiations were going on, this new front was opened in western Sudan, which is a totally geographically and ethnically different group than the ones you had in the south. And Baroness Cox already in 2002, I mean, the fighting started in 2003, 2004 when Darfurian rebel groups attacked the government posts. But you already had what you had in Darfur, the whole region. You have had a process of drought and desertification for three, four decades now, a long process. And living conditions have been deteriorating there. And with civil wars, foreign invasions, and sanctions imposed on Sudan for more than 20 years, the government could not do any or launch any development programs in that region. So that the human, the social and economic conditions in Western Darfur were used by both these political groups inside Sudan, but also internationally from the British and others to start a new front against the government of Sudan.
All right, Hussein, let me just follow that up then, because I think this is the next question we have to answer. If, in fact, the government has been making progress with the peace negotiations, you have the comprehensive peace agreement, you have ongoing negotiations in the region where there has been fighting, then what Mr. LaRouche contends and what you presented at this conference is that there's another motive for the attack on the government of Sudan, and the only conclusion that can be reached is that this is a continuation of the British effort to destroy a potentially powerful nation state. Why don't you just develop that a little bit for our listeners? Because I think this is something that we've got to get across to people in the United States, that they're being played for suckers in this broader Sykes-Picot geometry.
Yes, exactly. The thing is, this is exactly the point, because, you know, many of the points of this fight going on in Sudan is actually, it signifies, or it's a special case for revealing a number of points of what the British are trying to do, not only in Sudan, but in all of Africa and globally. Because on the one hand, you have, first of all, the one target in this process is the idea of national sovereignty. The whole ICC operation and what Tony Blair started already in the 1990s is that the time of the Peace of Westphalia and national sovereignty is over. And now it is the time for imperial so-called humanitarian intervention against dictatorships, against failed states, against genocide, and so on. So the first target in this operation is the national sovereignty of not only Sudan, but everywhere, because you create a precedent for this type of intervention. Of course, we had with the lies from Tony Blair and Cheney, Iraq was invaded, but this time it's more serious because what they are trying to create is an international agreement to violate the sovereignty of a nation and to issue an arrest warrant of a sitting president, which is another violation of international law and also based on the Westphalian peace. The second point is what this case of Sudan signifies is this idea of economic dictatorship. Because the Sudanese government, actually since the early 1990s, they defied the IMF. They were told by the IMF if they leave the idea of self-sufficiency of food, then they will get help from the IMF. And actually the United States offered Sudan almost free wheat and flour, and as they did with the Egyptians many years, so they do not grow their own. You know, you say, you get it for free, why do you want to grow your own food? So the Sudan government, they defied and they stopped their collaboration with the IMF and the World Bank, and they got enormous sanctions. The interesting thing is that also what both Larry Freeman and I presented at the conference is this idea of the right of nations to use and develop their own resources for their own development. You know, the case of the National Security Study Memorandum 200, which was put together by Henry Kissinger, but it's the one important element of the British Empire, which says that population growth in third world countries, especially in a large country, the largest countries, is a threat to the security of the United States and its allies, because these nations would need to use their own resources to develop their own economies, to feed their own people. And that's not allowed by the empire. And Sudan did exactly that, because with this peace process with southern Sudan, what happened too is that the Sudanese managed to get help to pump out the oil, which is in that conflict area, and export it, build refineries, use it for their own benefit, but they exported it. And they got into agreements with China, with India, with Japan and Malaysia for long-term credit based on the export of oil. But instead of the oil, they would get help and development of infrastructure, as we mentioned in the case of the Merowe Dam and the development projects there. That's also one point which the empire can never forgive you for doing it. The other thing is which also punches a hole into the whole British Empire and Prince Philip's Worldwide Fund Greenie Empire ideas, that the fight for man's divine right to transform nature and increase the productivity of nature around him by the creative intervention by human beings, by building infrastructure, transferring water to dry areas to grow more food, to expand society, to expand economic activity, to improve the living conditions of the whole people. This is also has been taking place in Sudan. And therefore, you know, the case of Sudan is very important at this moment because it has all these elements which defies the empire.
Well, I want to just stop you there for a second, because I want to make sure that those people listening to this program direct your friends, direct people you talk to, to this program in archive form on the LaRouche Pub site, because what you've just heard for the last half hour is a complete refutation of what you hear on CNN, on Fox, what you hear from people like Susan Rice, what you heard from Condoleezza Rice, the former Secretary of State. And it's crucial that people understand that there are nations fighting for survival. We will take email questions that for Hussein and for Summer at radio@larouchepub.com. I also want to call people's attention to, on the LaRouche Pub site 2 weeks ago in the EIR, there's extensive articles and coverage of the trip of the LaRouche delegation to Sudan. Now, Hussein, you brought something up that I'd like to throw to Summer, that is the Marowei Dam. I understand that you toured the dam, you had a trip there, and this is an area where the government does have control. What did you see there, Summer?
Well, Hussein's got a whole lot on this, but we saw, essentially, we drove about 3.5 hours from Khartoum to the Marowei Dam, and the whole trip was desert. And as you see in the EIR archive that we've got on the website, all you really see are goats and camels on eating trees every once in a while where there's a tree or a shrub.
Larry said there were skinny camels.
That's true. They were very skinny. I don't know how long they had. And then we made it to an area. Probably for a good 30 to 45 minutes, we were driving through a lush green area to the dam where they had started to irrigate this whole region. People who were formerly nomadic were now becoming integrated into a society that had been built up around the dam. The government had a whole move of about, I think it was about 70,000 people or so from one area of a certain standard of living to a much better standard of living in order to construct this dam. And they had this is where all the dates in the country come from. They're grown right next to this dam, among other things. But there's a lot of other stuff that Hussein's covered in his article that he's gone through. But it was quite extraordinary, a huge contrast from 3.5 hours of driving.
Well, Summer, you're from California, where you had similar kinds of developments with the All-American Canal and the Imperial Canal, where desert land was transformed into some of the most important vegetable and fruit-growing areas of the country. Did you get a sense of some similar potential in Sudan, that you can take desert and, sometimes they say that because desert has not, the land has not been leached of its minerals, once you add water, you actually have fairly fertile soil. Did you get a good sense of that?
Yeah. I don't know all the details, but apparently a huge and extraordinary amount of Sudanese soil is fertile. And this is just one small fraction right around the Marowei Dam, which itself was huge and is producing a bunch of food, not including the fact that you're producing a bunch of electricity that's going all the way from the dam to Khartoum, 3.5 hour drive south. But the whole region is waiting to be irrigated, and the Arab world knows this. They know that with the food that could be produced with the soil of Sudan, you could feed the whole Arab world, you could feed Africa. And that's just with this one country. It's huge, huge land area.
Now, Hussein, one of the other stories we get in the U.S. press is that the Chinese are mucking around in Sudan, that the Chinese want to get the oil, and that this is a big threat to Western interests. Are the Chinese there, and if they are, what are they doing?
Yeah, well, the Chinese came in because the United States and Europe refused to work with the Sudanese. The Sudanese were begging the United States and Europe to come and help develop the oil resources. And then in 2004, 2005, as I said, in the time when the government was going with the peace process with the southern Sudanese rebels, suddenly everybody withdrew, and they left the Sudanese alone. So the Sudanese went eastward. They got help from Malaysia, they got help from China and other countries to develop their oil wells. They started drilling oil, they started building this long 2,000-kilometer pipeline to the Red Sea, and the Chinese actually helped them do that. They helped them build two major oil refineries, petrochemical industries, and so on and so forth. So why shouldn't they do it? I mean, the Chinese themselves, in order not to upset, in their typical way, not to upset the United States and others, say, well, we are just doing business. Well, this is the right kind of business. You get oil, you deliver something. And by the way, we saw the trucks, which the BBC channel a few months ago said were used to kill people in Darfur. We saw these white trucks in the, at the dam project where the Chinese drivers were driving machines and equipment back and forth at the dam building.
So they weren't loaded up with bodies? They actually had machinery?
No, it was loaded with machines, loaded with workers. And it's a beautiful scene because there you see the Chinese, you see Africans, you see Indians, you see some Europeans who are consultants there, actually, from Germany, Austria, and some other places. But you see this, the world getting together there to develop that area. And as I mentioned in my report about this, this is not simply a dam project, because this is like what you had in the United States at the Tennessee Valley Authority, because the government has projects for three major dams. They have built six major bridges. They are building hospitals, airports, food conservation factories, which is a big problem in Africa. You produce food, but it then gets spoiled by the heat and insects. But the government has been near the site of the dam, because you have electricity now. It's not that much, but it's already doubling the output of electricity in the country. So with electricity, with water, with transport, you are transforming the whole region. I mean, this is what is needed is much, much more. But this is an example of how you can transform a dead land area. And Sudan is the largest African country. And 40% of the land of Sudan is cultivable land. So you just bring some water, you bring build water canals, roads, build villages, modern villages, and so on. Which they have been doing around the Merowe Dam. They have the most modern hospitals are in that area now. But this is what the tragedy is, that this is not happening all over Africa, because in all over Africa, in many parts of Africa, have these huge rivers, the Zambezi, the Congo River, the Iranian River, but they are not developed. If you build a few dams, if you build water canals, you can transform the whole continent. And therefore, you know, the idea of genocide, that what we have had is, yes, we have had genocide in Africa, but it has been a genocide, a silent genocide imposed on Africa by the British Empire and their allies by preventing Africa from development. That's what genocide is, really. Because in other parts of Africa where you don't have civil war, people are dying by millions of malaria because somebody came with the idea to prohibit the DDT, because there is no water development, there is no clean water. 400,000 Congolese die every year, not of fighting, they die of the lack of clean water. Most of them are children. Mm-hmm. So there is a genocide in Africa, but it's a genocide imposed on these nations by the British Empire through underdevelopment.
And the irony there is that the Obama administration, under the impetus of Larry Summers, went to London not that long ago and signed an agreement to expand the power of the International Monetary Fund, which has been the agency that has imposed the underdevelopment on Africa. Summer, let me ask you, from your experience there, if the United States were to change its policy and say, we want to come in and help you with dams, with power plants, and things of that sort, would the United States be welcome?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's in all of the discussions we had with government figures. They were, the repeated theme was, we're ready to give the United States a chance again, despite everything. We're ready to work with the United States. And I think I just wanted to just pull back just to investigate this British question one more, just a little bit more.
Sure.
The role of the Muslim Brotherhood in Sudan is big, because what happened was, right as the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was coming about, as Hussein was talking about, there was an attack against government infrastructure, including security forces and infrastructure needed for people, that emerged in 2003, and the government responded to that. These attacks on the government were coming in the midst of this Comprehensive Peace Agreement negotiation, was coming from the Muslim Brotherhood grouping that that Bashir had kicked out in 1999.
This was Al-Turabi and that crowd?
Yeah, Hassan Al-Turabi.
Yeah.
And then all the leadership of the group is living in London and Paris, of these rebel groups. And that's one of the things that the governor of Darfur was telling us. And so what's clear to them is that if the U.S. decided to work with them, they would know, they would be very welcome to it, which is very different than their view they have of Europe.
Well, Summer, to extend your point, if the U.S. were to join with the ICC and the British and the Europeans to destroy the current government of Sudan, it's possible that Sudan would then fall into the hands of these same fundamentalist Muslim Brotherhood networks that are
exactly
moving toward power in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Exactly.
Well, let me take this as an opportunity to move into the broader regional picture. For those who are joining us late, we had an assessment from Lyndon LaRouche just a couple of hours ago that a visit by Larry Summers, the same Larry Summers who is continuing the policy of bailing out the bankrupt banks, looting the American people to provide funds for the derivative traders and swindlers who have broken down the global financial system, that same Larry Summers stuck his fat belly into the Israeli embassy the other day, a couple days ago, and basically gave a green light to Benjamin Netanyahu, and more importantly, essentially indicated, as LaRouche said, that the Obama administration is breaking with the policy thus far of Senator Clinton in the broader region of the Middle East and especially on this Israeli-Palestinian situation. Hussein, you're one of the leading experts on this in the EIR. Where do things stand right now in this broader picture between, first of all, Israel and Palestine, the Gaza situation? We talk about humanitarian crises. What about the situation faced by the people who literally still live in the equivalent of refugee camps in Gaza?
Well, the living conditions there have actually been worse since the Israeli attack, because people in Gaza are not really getting all the help and aid they need, both for sustaining their lives but also to rebuild what has been destroyed. I mean, there wasn't much infrastructure there, but there was some, which was keeping people alive, like in a refugee camp situation. But even that does not really exist now. But also what is more scary for people is the prospects, for the future. I mean, the region is still a powder keg. Nothing in principle has changed since Dick Cheney wanted to start this Shia-Sunni global war starting from the region between Iran, Syria, Hezbollah on the one hand, and then Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and the so-called Sunni countries. That is still in place because the British are playing the Saudis, the Saudis have been part of the Anglo-Dutch Empire, as LaRouche has been saying. That's for good reasons. They are still playing their dirty games with propaganda against Iran, against Hezbollah, against Syria, and against any prospects for a dialogue between the United States and Syria and Iran especially.
So Hussein, this is what LaRouche means when he says there's a Sykes-Picot geometry, that this is the old British divide and rule policy.
Yes, exactly. And also what you have is that when Netanyahu became elected, Benjamin Netanyahu is hell-bent on starting a war in the whole region, started with bombing Iran. And he needs the slightest signal from the United States to do that. So the brakes have been on for some time now, but the situation now is very fragile, and any encouragement, as you say, by Larry Summers or anybody else in the Obama administration, even with words, would mean that the Israelis would launch their aircraft and go and attack Iran, and what that would mean, this is the classical breakaway allies, that the United States will be forced to back Israel in a new regional war against Iran, which will become an international war, a global war. And therefore, this situation is actually much worse than before, but everybody is sitting there and waiting for the Obama administration to make up its mind. It has gone almost 3 months since Senator Mitchell was there. It has been 2 months since Hillary Clinton has been there. Very good signs, but everybody is puzzled and of course scared by the prospect of what the Netanyahu government is going to do there.
Well, let me ask you on that, because we have an email from someone who is a very strong supporter of Hillary Clinton during her campaign, Brian Crowell from up in the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area, who's asking where does Hillary Clinton stand in this? Now, you said that there were positive signs with Secretary of State Clinton's trip, Mitchell's trip. What is it they were trying to do, and how would this be sabotaged by this summer's announcement?
I mean, I think basically what they were trying to do is to tell the whole region there in the Islamic world that there will be a totally different U.S. policy than the one you have seen coming from Bush and Cheney. And that was very good news for a lot of people. And there were these moves to have open a dialogue with Syria, to have some overtures with the Iranians, even though not directly, indirectly, and so on and so forth, and that there will be the U.S. is committed to a two-state solution for the Palestinians. The U.S. is committed to relieving the situation for the people in Gaza, and so on. So these were very, very good signs. But the thing is, what people want to see now is actions, and especially when Netanyahu comes to the United States soon. And that's where everybody is sitting there and waiting. In the meantime, you have forces in the region, as you say, the Saudis and the British are still working to create the conditions for a regional war of ethnic and sectarian nature, exactly as we had during or under the Bush-Cheney period. And this is the whole, what you said, is the Sykes-Picot mentality is still there. And it's, of course, supported by an enormous amount of anti-Americanism, which we saw in Sudan, is you see a totally different attitude from the Sudanese and Africans towards the United States, because they still see the United States as a positive force in history. They still remember the policies of the United States before the Second World War. They still
the Franklin Roosevelt tradition.
Franklin Roosevelt policy and ideas. People still know that, and they also know that the United States did not have any imperial legacy in Africa. But then you see the people who come from Egypt, Libya, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and these areas, they have a totally different mentality, which is tainted by this Sykes-Picot thing, is that they don't see the British hand in the game. The only thing they see is that these are the Arab countries are divided. They are pro-Americans. These are the traitors. And then there are the anti-Americans. These are the resistance movements. And that's the world for them. So they don't see anything positive coming in. And you hear their speeches, and it's just, wailing wall thing. Everybody's wailing, you know, we have been beaten by the United States, right. We are being tortured by the United States, we have been treated badly by the United States, and all the evils that in the world come from the United States.
Well, Hussein, you have an Arab language website for the LaRouche movement, do you not?
Yes, we do have
that. And how is that received? I know that you were given an opportunity to speak with a number of journalists in Sudan. Is Mr. LaRouche's idea of the British Empire and Sykes-Picot versus the FDR tradition, is that getting out in the Arab world?
That's getting out to quite a lot. There are circles, there are groups who are getting a very clear idea of that in the recent few years, especially since 9/11. Mr. LaRouche has become a well-known person, publicly before it was known among political circles. But now you go and look for LaRouche on the internet in Arabic and you find thousands of articles, and there are weekly reports. Whatever we write in our Arabic website is immediately picked up by newspapers, by internet sites, discussion groups, publicized in the Arab countries, but especially in Sudan, we have had the the recognition of this British problem, whereas in other countries in the Middle East, that's still not clear very much for people. Mm-hmm. And actually, a recent visit by a high-level delegation from Sudan, including the advisors of the president, the same people who were engaged in inviting Mr. LaRouche and us and organizing this conference, where we told them the problem is the British and Lord Malloch Brown personally and George Soros. So they went to France 2 weeks ago to meet with the foreign minister, Bernard Kouchner, because France is very much involved in the Darfur situation for old imperial reasons. Chad was a colony. Mm-hmm. But what happened there is that the French foreign minister invited Lord Mark Malloch Brown from the British Foreign Office and Commonwealth, the same person who wants to destroy Sudan, and said, the British are our friends. We need them in the talks. So what happens is that the Sudanese delegation who went there with a goodwill, with good intentions to tell the Europeans there's need for supporting the peace process in Darfur and the development rather than starting a new war by pushing this ICC, the French and the British told them no. President al-Bashir hands himself over to the ICC, and then we talk.
So they got a first-hand
experience of what we have been talking to them about.
The problem is the
British and this old imperial structure. So their hopes are, I tell you, their hopes are that the United States will have a totally different approach. This is the only hope for Sudan. It's the only hope for Africa. And I think people in the United States should very clearly realize that.
And from your vantage point, the European Union is still very much under the influence of Soros, Malloch Brown, the British imperial approach.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you look at these organizations from the ICC to the International Crisis Group, you look, it's organized in like a pyramid with the British and Dutch on the top, and then you have the other Europeans beneath, including the Scandinavians, where I live now. That they are fanatically Anglophile, they're fanatically pro-British. And what we are trying to do here in Europe is to give people a sense, and now that they're at the European Parliament, the European Parliament elections, what we are trying to give people a sense of course, we don't support a pan-European state, but we are using this election campaign to give people an idea that we have to destroy the British imperial policy. We have to have a totally new policy, especially what we have now with the auto industry being shut down gradually all over Europe. What we are saying to people here in Europe is that the future of the auto industry is in Africa. Should do exactly like the Chinese have been doing, get into long-term agreements, credit agreements, trade agreements with Africa, whereas you can produce, instead of cars, you cannot sell. You can produce trucks, you can produce bulldozers, you can produce machines, you can produce material and things that the Africans need to build their continent. And this way you can create a fair trade policy like Franklin Roosevelt was intending to do and save your own economy, save yourself also morally, because the plight of Africa comes from Europe, comes from the British, but also the Europeans who have supported a British imperial policy.
And, of course, the other side of that is under Larry Summers, we have the U.S. auto industry being dismantled and shut down when there is such a need globally for the products of these kinds of machine tool capabilities. Summer, let me get back to you, because the target of much of the work of Soros and Malloch Brown and the so-called Darfur committees is young Americans, students, college campuses. You're going to be back in the United States sometime soon. Did you talk at all about, with your group, of mapping out a tour of campuses, a series of events, to see if there's some way we can bring this real story that you and Hussein have been presenting to the people on the campuses who otherwise are going to be herded to support British genocide?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of what came up was the potential of having a group of the General Union of Sudanese Students perhaps coming to the United States and us giving them. We had representatives from Howard University, one young woman from Georgetown, but something where we could have some sort of open dialogue setting where they would be there or something along those lines, if possible. But going to these campuses and really going to all these events, as many as we can, and it doesn't seem like it would take too much to get someone to understand that they have absolutely no clue as to what's really going on in Sudan at all, or even in Africa. And given what we've gone through here on the show, the vast majority of people who think they know something about Sudan really don't know anything, and it's just kind of become a popular line to toss around on the campuses.
But isn't that something you find, especially you're up in the politically correct, liberal Berkeley, Stanford, isn't this generally that people just assume that, just as they assume that nuclear power is going to melt the planet and the polar ice caps, they assume that Sudan is bad?
Yeah, pretty much. It's a belief. It comes down to the definitions, axioms, and the postulates of the general population. But it's something that you can make fun of, and you can quickly, very quickly, get someone to understand that they know absolutely nothing about the situation.
Well, Summer, I hope that you'll see this as a very important responsibility, not just for you, but for the LaRouche Youth Movement to take up, because as we've been talking during the course of this hour, it's clear that what Lynn talked about Tuesday, about the defining moment of the United States for your generation, is going to be once and for all defeating this Anglo-Dutch-Saudi empire. And right now with the, in a sense, what Summers just did, if in fact this is, as LaRouche says, a break with the Clinton networks that had been part of the Obama administration, this will make the situation much more clearly defined. But that this is a defining moment. Will the United States go back to its traditions, or will we be nothing but an enforcer for the British Empire? And I think that's what we have to get across to American college students.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that what we're going to do is first we're going to put together a video on the LPAC site on the situation in Sudan, our presence there. And that'll be out in probably about 2 or 3 weeks. And then after that, I'll be back on the west coast of the United States. And the video should serve the purpose of presenting to people a very different idea about what's actually happening in Sudan that they can use, or we can use it in the organizing process to expose the lies about this, as we've put out.
And Hussein, I know, I believe you're a candidate. Are you not in the upcoming elections in Sweden?
Yes, I'm the lead candidate together with 18 other Swedish citizens.
And is this fight against the British Empire, I assume that's a major part of your campaign?
Yeah, I mean, our campaign is we have, as our opening, we had a public meeting on defeating the British imperial policy. But it also, we have, as in our recent campaign pamphlet we did, is that there's two major focuses is to defeat the financial empire with a Pecora Commission. A commission in every country in Europe and the United States to investigate the corruption and the policies which have created this crisis and the ones who are responsible for it, to reverse the whole last 40 years of bubble economy and British-controlled, City of London-controlled international globalization. And on the other hand, we have the deep crisis of the auto industry, which we are telling people, as I said previously in the program, that if you want to save Europe, you have to build Africa. That's our moral and reality imperative at the moment. And that means defeating the British imperial policy and working together with African nations as sovereign nation states, not as subjects of Her Majesty.
Well, that sounds like a pretty powerful campaign. I hope we can get you back on the program as the campaign develops. When are the elections?
The voting, well, the election day is the 7th of June. So we
right.
have about 1 month now.
Okay, well, we'll have to have you back on sometime around then to give us a report on how it's developing. Look, I'd really like to thank the two of you. This has been a highly informative discussion, and it is very essential that the axioms that Summer was just talking about be broken, and that the American people recognize that we have this tradition, this Roosevelt tradition. One of the best ways to understand that is go to LaRouchePact.com and look at what Lyndon LaRouche delivered on April 28th, the webcast he gave from Washington, D.C. The other shoe has dropped. Watch that. Volunteer to work with LaRouche PAC. Contribute funds. We're fighting to save the nation from this runaway network of fascists, the Larry Summers, Peter Orszag crowd. And what we've had today is a beautiful exposition of what this fight means for Africa and as well what it means to save the soul of Europe and the United States. So Hussein and Summer, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us with you.
This has been the LaRouche Show. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.